Why can't you leave me alone?
Because I want to see you get out of here.
You don't deserve to be here.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 4, Episode 5, Drawing Henry. And now, here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting. Oh, wow.
Yes!
Stank! The stank.
Thank you so much for that edit, Dave. For those
who are not
$5 Patreons, that was, of course, Jenny Garth saying our names in the very recent episode of Again With Them. I mean, specifically, she said it on her podcast, and then we clipped it for Again With Them. But yes, another one of those coming at the end of the month. So get your finances in order. Pledge at the $5 level or up, and you can hear our thoughts on the latest batch of July episodes, plus all of those archives, which are a hoot. For our Patreon supporters at all levels, we also do four bonus episodes every month. And the one dropping this week, specifically on Friday, July 23rd, let's watch Jenny Garth in Left 4 Dead: The Ashley Reeves Story. This is on the Lifetime site. You do need to have a cable subscription to log in and access it for free. We will link that in the show notes. But if you are not a cable subscriber, it is also for sale on iTunes and for sale or rent on Amazon. So go to patreon.com/againwiththis to join us on Patreon and hear our thoughts on that this week. Now, our thoughts on Season 4, Episode 5, Drawing Henry. Shall we begin?
Yes, we shall.
All right. Let's start with our C plot. Joe is still not wild about Shelley, and her bosses are still bickering. Richard is back to being pissy, now at the unveiling of the new Hart and Mancini sign, which you can see in the visual aids. They switched fonts. Good call, but it is still real ugly.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. I mean, the fact that it is any improvement at all really says much more about the previous sign than it does about how, quote, good this one is, which is to say that it is not.
I concur. Jane is like, your name is first. We got the line of credit. What's your problem? And he says it's the fact that they have different agendas instead of what I would have said, which is, for the 30th time, a woman I loved is dead. Also, this new sign just completely erased her. Mm-hmm. Would have been fair. But when Jane chases after Richard to discuss it more, he says he wants more of a commitment from her and she wants more time to think about it. She claims she's committed, but she knows a designer's only as good as their last line.
Yeah. My note said, then you should learn to type, girly, because oof.
And then she says she fears that if she tries to do two new things at once, she will fail at both. Bitch, you've been engaged twice before and married once already. What are you talking about? Neither of these things is new.
Yeah. Also, you can tell she doesn't believe what she's saying as she's saying it. So, yeah. This storyline is so weird. I mean, I'll have more specific comments about this, but like, it's so hard to tell where we're supposed to think they are, like, emotionally, because first of all, the storyline doesn't really make any emotional sense, even for a soap.
Yeah.
And second of all, Patrick Muldoon's line readings are like the fucking Smithers screensaver. So it's like impossible, like there is a certain, I guess, opacity that is compelling, except it's only because he's a bad actor and not because he's trying to go for anything ambiguous. I've made this comment before, but yeah, like we're really going to see that in the next couple of episodes that it's like, is the twist that he's a robot? Right. Like, I don't get it. Anyway.
Yeah. Let's continue with the scene because I have more to say about that too. She just wants to feel more secure and he nags that some people think security is being in the arms of someone who loves them. So she asks to keep the ring until she gets there and he tells her not to take too long or he will find someone else to give it to. And we have said this a lot about many couples over the years. You hate each other. Like, what is he fighting for?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like, also, fire her, please.
Mm-hmm.
She's been insubordinate and disrespectful in your relationship and at work. And I really don't understand this thing on these franchises where, like, I asked you to marry me. You said, I'll think about it.
Right.
We're just going to act like we're still dating. Like, that's no, that is a fork in the road. And if you did not agree on which fork to take, you broke up.
Yeah.
Kelly, Brandon.
Right. Yeah. And like, especially since the moments of conflict that they keep having, like up until this point, after this, he doesn't really talk about Mackenzie anymore. But prior to this point, it's been a lot of like, she just died. Like, give me a break. When Jane was like pushing him harder for a relationship. And now they're on completely opposite sides where he's like, yes, okay, I want to get married. And she's like, nah. Like,
yeah. But then her rationale for that is not, you are trying to replace one wife with another so you don't have to contend with your grief / guilt. Like, right. I'm sure this isn't his motivation. And even if it were, like, what an like array of people unable to sell complicated emotions in this cast.
Yeah.
And then a whole bunch who, like, if you gave this job to Laura Layton, she would have no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Patrick Muldoon, who just looks like he, I don't know, ate some tuna salad that had gone off. Like,
yeah,
that is an emotion, but not for every scene.
All right. So Richard then calls Joe in on the pretext of asking her to make some posters for the lobby, but really to enlist her to urge Jane to accept his proposal. Joe claims she'll see what she can do and then flirtatiously tells him at the door how lucky Jane is. And he says he is. It's neither of you, but let's move on.
Yeah. Also, why? I hate that Joe is getting dragged into this plot line. This does not work for me either. But anyway.
Well, looking ahead to future episodes now, I'm seeing where it goes. I hate it even more, but we'll get there.
Word.
So Joe gets home that night to see Jake swimming laps. He tells her to join him, and as she's going upstairs to change and get him a beer, she sees Shelly come out of Jake's place already with beers and sit on the edge of the pool before she can get back. Shelly asks to join him, and he casually says yes, adding that Joe is coming down in a second. Points for transparency. But actually, Joe is coming down now to say she has too much work to do, which, like, this is not the play. Go put your swimsuit on. Just be around them. Why would you, if you're worried that she's making a play for him, why would you absent yourself?
Also, I mean, this is such an idiot plot, even for a soap. Like, I try to grade on a curve,
sure.
But it's like, since everybody's doubling up with roommates.
I mean, you said this before and you're right.
Like, yeah.
It's the solution's right there.
Yeah. Y'all two just bunk together, put Matt in with Shelly. He's, you know, off depositioning, spoiler.
Right.
And like, it's fine.
Also, Matt will Shelly take the couch.
Sucks.
He's a doormat.
Yeah. Exactly. He's not gonna say anything.
No. Anyway, Jake runs after Joe to dissuade her, showing us, by the way, he's in actual swim trunks and not cutoffs, which I was pleased to see.
I was a little bummed. It was
off-brand.
Oh, no. I like wet jorts. I'm from New Jersey. It's
okay.
It's a problem.
All right.
Don't get up. I'll fire myself.
Anyway, Joe then lets Jake know how insecure she actually is in clip two.
Hey, I'm talking to you.
What? Oh, you want to talk? Let's talk about you inviting Shelly into the pool.
I don't believe this.
You don't believe what? Come on in. I mean, this pool just wouldn't be the same without Shelly in her string bikini. Would it, Jake?
Is that what this is about? You're jealous because she looks good in a bikini?
Oh, God, this is pathetic. Shelly's been wrapping you around her finger ever since she got here. She's playing the needy waif, the grieving widow, the helpful bookkeeper, you know, whatever she thinks will get to you. I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't even know Jess.
Ease up, Joe. You're out of line here.
Am I? Really? Well, you just made your choice.
Fine.
Wait.
No.
why? Let's just follow this logic trail. Let's say Shelley didn't know Jess. Like, what does Joe think she's going to get out of Jake, who it was recently established is, like, already having money problems at Shooters? Like, what is she digging, you know? Like, if it's a hot guy, okay, it's a long way to come to try to get together with a hot guy that you just randomly found. Like, are we supposed to think that she read Jess's obituary in the paper and there was a photo of Jake there? Like, of course she knew Jess. Shut up, Joe.
Yeah. Also, I mean, she didn't know he died. So what was the play?
Right. Yeah.
Like, what was the play? She was, like, trying to get back together with Jess. And also, would anyone like to recall that Jess was, like, basically gaslighting Jake, beat the shit out of Joe, and then was thrown off a building and broke Jake's fall, saving his life and dying himself? Like, this is not, like, the way that everybody's playing this is, like, this cute, insecure, like, I don't know, obstacle to Joe and Jake's relationship, which is, I'm exhausted by, like, just get them together. They have great chemistry.
Yes.
Stop fucking with it.
Yes.
But also,
that's not how
the brother
works,
slash ex-boyfriend, like, died. Duh. And why is Shelley even here and cast to play her, someone who cannot act?
Yeah. No.
Like, it's, the it's Lady true. Muldoon. No.
It's true. And the other problem with this storyline is something that happens a lot in TV shows when they have season-ending cliffhangers and then the premiere picks up right after. Mm-hmm. So that, like, in show world, no time has passed. But then for viewers and for all the people playing it, like, 4 months passed or whatever. Yeah. So there's always a gap between, like, wait, it's like what we were saying with Richard and Jane. Like, you guys have been together for, like, 3 weeks. Like, you know, you can't get married. This is stupid.
Yeah.
But it's the same with this, where they're, like, they're acting as if they've had, you know, months to be in the acceptance phase or whatever. And, like, no, it's only been a relatively short time for all of this trauma to just be, like, in your past.
Yeah.
The next morning, Joe gives Jane her paranoid version of the previous night's events. Also, there's another reference to Shelley's tiny bikini, which, like, you can see it in the visual aids. It's a perfectly normal bikini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
Standard. Compared to the ones in the Miami Vice credits, it's actually rather modest.
Right. Joe's like, if Shelley wears that tiny bikini when anyone might just walk by, what does she wear when they're alone in Jake's apartment? Ugh, shut up. Joe doesn't feel like competing with Shelley, so does Jane think Joe should just give her money to set her up somewhere else or move her in with Joe herself? And again, I must point out Sarah's excellent point in former episodes and this one. You live with Jake. Shelley lives with Matt. Problem solved. How dumb are you? Anyway.
Yeah, come on.
Jane says Joe can't do anything. Jake's being kind to Shelley to help him get through his own guilt about Jess. True. Joe then abruptly changes the subject to Richard, basically asking Jane what her problem is. Jane is interested in Richard, but the next line is the most important thing in her life right now. She knows relationships are important too, but she can't divide her attention. Also, what does Joe care? And Joe's like, I just want the best for you and for you to keep an open mind. And as they're walking out on their way to work, they run into Shelley, who is waiting on Jake's doorstep to talk to Joe. Clip 3.
Look. Honestly, I sleep on the couch.
I don't want to hear it, Shelley.
Okay. But you can't say I didn't try.
Huh? Oh, no. I would never say that.
If this wasn't so idiotic, I would kind of like that exchange. But there's also a moment where Joe stops to look at Shelley and Jane is, like, slightly behind her and gives her, like, a gorgeous side eye you can see in the visual aids. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Yeah, it is very good. And Zuniga is, like, killing it with this sort of insecure eye roll, like, voice of the audience crap that she has to play. Sometimes it's funny, but then if you stop to think about it for 2 seconds, it's like, what?
It's true.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So then Jo's wrapping up a photo shoot when she gets a call from Jake ordering her up to a room in the hotel where she is shooting. So then we see her at his door. She's in a skater skirt and thigh-high tights, which is Mwah, chef's kiss, 95.
Oh my God, it really is. Also, I think that might be Dylan's room at the Bellage when he comes back to the show.
I think it's just a room. It's not a suite, but it's definitely a Bellage place. But anyway, looking put upon, she says, the room is beautiful. It's fine. And he says, so is she, and hands her some roses. And she pretends this move doesn't work on her, but we know it does because she sits on the bed so he can apologize for being a jerk. Shelley means nothing to him, and he was overly solicitous of her out of guilt. And he also said things to Joe that he didn't mean. But he loves her. She loves him, too. Fine for both of them. The next day, Joe in her wildly shiny white satin dress. I know you have things to say about this.
It is so shiny. And it's like the faux wrap dress with a collar that's no. It just looks like the like gift wrap.
Yeah.
It's not cute.
It's like the quality of cheap fake satin that tiny girl flower dresses are made out of. Like, mm-hmm. It's just that cheap and that shiny.
Correct.
Of course it is in the visual aids. Mm-hmm. So Joe and this dress bring Jane slides at the office. And while Jane is inspecting them, Joe notices Jane's wearing her ring. And Jane confirms she got over her concerns and decided not to let Richard go after all. And things get weird quickly. Clip 4.
I have you to thank. I mean, you saw how terrific he was before I did.
Oh, you to come around. Size was not to like, right? What?
I don't know. It just... The relationship is perfect on paper, and I know I should love him. But I don't. Not really. I mean, not the way I loved Michael. But then again, look how that turned out. Richard's good for me. I'll just learn to love him.
Try. I'd hate to think that you could only be happy with men who make you miserable.
I think the answer, if you say I was happier with the man who emotionally abused me, is you should have some therapy before you think about getting married again.
Yeah.
Like, all Richard asked Joe to do was talk to Jane, and she did. Like, you know, she did what she was asked for whatever reason, God knows, for plot reasons, of course. But, you know, this is where you're like, oh, okay, shit. Like, this wasn't just getting you over some cold feet or some concerns. This was like, you straight up do not love this guy and know it and are telling people. This is fucked up.
But here again, it's like, of course you don't love him. You barely know him.
Yeah.
You've been doing it for 3 weeks. Like, right.
Yeah.
I don't think this is actually fatal. Why don't you just date for a while? But mm-hmm. This is a soap. So, yeah.
And at Shooters, Jake is in his office being performatively frustrated for Shelley's benefit. I mean, I don't think he actually is, but that's how it kind of comes across when she duly starts giving him a shoulder massage. And he's enjoying it before he realizes he's enjoying it and then stops her, climbing out from under her hands to let her down easy. He is with Joe, and Shelley's like, we didn't do anything. Jake isn't sure how long that will be true if she continues living with him. She was hoping to save some more money before getting her own place, but Jake says he can't risk the relationship he and Joe just rekindled. Why is, okay, I'll go back to where I was living before an option? Like, go back to Oregon. Did you give up your apartment and just get on the road and hope for the best? What?
Yeah, like, climate change hasn't happened yet. Just go back there. It's fine. Yeah.
Shelley didn't mean to get in their way, and she will start looking for a place immediately. She's grateful for everything Jake has done for her. And then when her back is turned, she gets kind of a schemey look and says she really only likes Jake as a friend, but then kisses him on the lips a little too long. And he watches her walk away like he's like, oh, great, we're on the same page, which, you know, they're not.
Oh, Jake.
Moving on to our B plot. Brooke tries to run interference between Amanda and Jack, while Haley tries to enlist Allison in the fight against the Campbell marriage. We start in Brooke's office at D&D, where things in her new job are not great. Amanda, in, by the way, a python print dress It's a real departure from her usual style. It looks great, though. You can see in the visual aids. She storms into Yellowbrook for approving something or other that was outside of Brooke's authority. And before they can argue about it very much, Jack calls from his Bellage hotel room and recaps his first meeting with Brooke for new viewers. With Amanda still standing there, Brooke writes "new client" on a notepad, but Amanda just stares at her hatefully and doesn't leave. And then Jack tries to arrange a meeting in the office, but Brooke suggests coffee out instead, smugly flouncing out of Amanda's tirade. And then after some new B-roll that includes the Johnny Rockets on Melrose, which I have been to, brag, not really. Dumps us out with Brooke meeting Jack at the coffee shop at the Bellage, not the Wilshire Hotel, as he had said he was staying at on the phone, probably because that does not exist, although there is a Hotel Wilshire. To her question, he says he found her by following the info on a business card she dropped at his place. He wondered why a woman who had told him she was in commercial real estate had a card from an ad agency. And he also knows she was only in Miami for a few hours and offers to give her a real tour if she goes back. He hopes that she will return the favor for him while he's in town. And she says she can suggest places for him to go, but she will not be going with him since she's married. But he doesn't care. If she doesn't tell her husband, he won't either. And Brooke's expression in response to this says she has already forgotten who Billy is. You can see this in the visual aids, too. Like, she's so horny for this guy. And even though, as we said, when he was first introduced, Antonio Sabato Jr. is a lunatic.
Yeah.
Like, bad politics style. He's very hot in this role. Sorry.
It's amazing how many of these this franchise gets. Like, what next? Scott Baio shows up? Like, I mean, but he actually was never my thing. But it's like, you know, Dean Cain is Reek. Like, okay, do I want to hang out with him now? No. Would I have torn him to shreds back then? Yes. Come on.
Yeah. That night, Billy is trying to get Brooke to pay attention to a project they're supposed to be working on, but she is preoccupied. Clip 5.
I've been thinking, Daddy hasn't called me in days.
For God's sake, Brooke, who cares?
I mean, once again, the broken actor is right twice a day, and this was perfect. He's like, oh, fucking, this fucking guy, like, so good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew Shue.
On the other hand, Billy, you knowingly married a woman who is an adult and calls her dad daddy. That's a red flag. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, yeah. I mean, on that same other hand, like, speaking of you hate each other, like, it's pretty evident we're supposed to think Billy thinks she's a total creep. Like, why? Go get it annulled.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't really get better from here. It's true.
No,
So Brooke thinks that her dad's silence means he is up to something. And on cue, the phone rings, but it's not Haley, it's Jack. And Brooke is suspicious about how he got her home number, so she has to cover to Billy, still in the room, that it's a CD company claiming she owes them money. Oh, the past.
Yeah. Oh, Schmolumbia,
you know,
house.
I owed them a lot of money at various points in my life. I don't think I ever got a phone call, but sure.
Yeah, I don't think they ever called my house, but yeah, yikes.
So Jack threatens to go around Brooke to Billy and say what? Not clear. If she doesn't meet him at the art museum the next morning, and she reluctantly agrees, thusly, clip 6.
Yeah, fine. I'll put the check in the mail tomorrow.
They say that's one of the three great lies.
Really?
Well played.
Yeah, not bad. Also, Billy makes several suspicious faces at the end of this scene, which are a poem, and you can see them in the visual aids. At LACMA the next morning, Brooke lets Jack know she is flattered and tempted, but she's in love with Billy. No, she's not. So could he please leave her alone? And when she starts to walk away, he detains her by what?
Grabbing her arm.
Correct. As he tells her he can't exit her life because of Brooke, he knows Amanda's alive and also that Brooke lied to him about how she happened to turn up at his house. He always knew Amanda wasn't going to be happy as a housewife when they were married. And guess what she always wanted to do? Advertising. So where is she? And Brooke claims she doesn't know, looking guilty AF. And Jack orders her not to insult his intelligence by lying to him. So under duress, here is the marginally more plausible lie she comes up with on the spot. Clip 7.
All right. I knew Amanda years ago. We were friends, but she borrowed money from me, and then she left town, and I haven't heard from her since.
How many years?
I don't remember. Four, maybe? Whatever signals you got from me in Miami, from seeing her portrait in your house.
Really? I thought it was an attraction to me.
That too.
Two things. Mm-hmm. So then Billy, who I guess followed Brooke, appears on the end of this in time to see Jack petting Brooke's face and looks smug to have figured it out for a while.
Or like he thinks he might have left the iron on.
Exactly. So later, Brooke is leaving a meeting at D&D when Billy shows up and physically shoves her back into the conference room to confront her about what he saw, reasonably assuming that she is cheating on him. And she promises to explain everything at home that night, but he refuses to wait because he's had it with her. So she actually tells him the truth, although she also adds that Jack has a weird sixth sense that Amanda is at D&D when all it would take for him is to call reception, ask for Amanda, and hang up.
Like my notes were like, you dropped a business card. I'm pretty sure that falls within the regulation five senses, but
yeah. Like, even assuming D&D doesn't have a website, which it's 1995, they might not, but, like, this is not a hard case to crack, so she doesn't know what to do. Billy tells her to tell Amanda, and Brooke babbles that she will. That night, Haley wanders through the courtyard and knocks on Jane's door, which, like, how does he even know that's where Allison is staying? But whatever, that's who he's looking for. Obviously, she's surprised to see him, but she lets him come in, and he hands her a package from Hong Kong that I guess is his pretext for coming over, but he quickly gets to the real reason, which is they have something in common. Neither of them wants Brooke and Billy to be married, and Allison doesn't deny that she's not wild about Haley himself after that whole thing where he made up a job to trick her into moving to Hong Kong. She doesn't know why she should trust him, and he's like, fair, but invites her to have dinner on his yacht the next night so he can explain. And he also gives her the address as though she doesn't already have her job interview on it. We saw it happen. Anyway, God. Then it's the next night, and Allison, dressed to not impress, she's in like an ankle-length skirt and a dowdy sweater, but you know, okay, intentions set, I guess.
Yep.
She shows up at the marina for dinner. He knows that she's sober and has sparkling cider on hand, which is considerate, but she just came to say she didn't want to be part of his plan. She tried using her blindness to win Billy back, and it didn't work, so now she's decided Brooke and Billy deserve to be happy, and she should get on with her life. But the table's set all fancy, and she's impressed, and Haley pours and toasts to getting on with your life. And I guess her pants have started melting already, because without even taking a sip, she quickly says she has an early day tomorrow and has to get going. And out on the dock, she stops to look back at the boat, gets her heel of her stupid mule tangled in a rope,
and
falls into the water. And he hears this. So I made a gif of her falling and Haley being like, what? In the visual aids, it's very funny. So he runs out to get her out of the disgusting water, like probably too late for her not to have swallowed dozens of parasites.
Typhoid. Yeah,
exactly. And a can's worth of oil. But they both crack up at her predicament and she lets him wrap a blanket around her and lead her back on board. And after dinner, she gets ready to leave. A door open to romance. Clip 8.
I'm glad you decided to stay.
Yeah, me too. Of course, my clothes are wet and I didn't have much choice except running up the pier naked.
True.
Not bad. Not bad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, what a pro to like summon a sincere laugh at that.
Mm-hmm.
Well done, Perry.
Yep. He's really good in this part. And also,
he really is.
He's so foxy, too.
Yeah. I mean, and the whole thing is really gross. So, like, not really remembering much about this plot line, except extremely broad strokes, like that he was on the show.
Right.
And like his jaw is literally a square. Like it's literally a right angle. Like none of this should work, but some of these people are extremely professional and then thrown into the great salad of Melrose are a couple of little teeny rotten cherry tomatoes like Patrick Muldoon that sort of keep it interesting.
Yep.
Oh.
Anywho, then there's clearly a charged moment where a kiss might happen, but Allison turns around to leave instead. And then she stops at the door or whatever, be call it on a fucking boat, to say goodnight again, which is when he leans in to kiss her and she eventually turns away. But we know he will get her soon enough by his look. Back to Brooke. She tries to pull Amanda aside at the office at least 2 days after Brooke and Billy agreed she needs to tell Amanda about Jack based on events that have happened in the interim. But sure, she was right on top of it. And
yeah.
Only Billy is around, so Amanda's like, just tell me. So Brooke says Jack is in L.A., but doesn't know where Amanda is, which, like, he definitely does. Mm-hmm. Amanda's horrified that Brooke didn't say something sooner because he will kill Amanda, but Brooke thinks he's probably already left town. Why would she think that?
Yeah.
Which is, of course, when she looks over Amanda's shoulder and sees him walking past reception and warns Amanda. And while Amanda and Billy run to her office, Brooke intercepts Jack. He knows Amanda works there and that Brooke told Amanda he was in town. Brooke denies that she did, claiming Amanda's been on vacation. So he says she's a bad liar, which she is in the way all TV characters are. Mm-hmm. She's been good before, now she's bad. But she's also been good enough to fool Billy, easy, Allison, medium, and Amanda, generally pretty challenging. But none of them is a mobster that we know of. Jack correctly guesses that Amanda saw him come in and took off. And then, clip 9.
Oh, by the way, I don't trust detectives. I didn't know she was here until you just told me.
This is so dumb. There are a million ways to find out who the president of an ad agency is. She is a public person. She was nominated for an award like 4 months ago in her industry. Like, anyway.
Yeah, this, I mean, some of the retcons that we're seeing, like, that fly in the face of not just logic, but, like, things that we have seen within the last season, it's just really, it's frustrating. The Kimberly situation also, although at least the actors at the center of each story are, like, they're killing it. Like, yeah. Locklear's doing a really good job looking terrified.
Yes.
She may be reacting to how stupid this setup is by the writers because of everything that you just said. Like, this is a public figure.
Yeah.
And also, if the FBI was, like, looking for her and basically threatening her with charges for being an accessory when Palmer lammed it, like...
Yeah.
Oh, show. You're better than this. And en conclusion... I kind of resent their turning Brooke. Like, it's satisfying in some ways for the viewer that Brooke is just, like, everything just is going wrong for the character now. But, like, there was something really satisfying about her successful scheming before.
Yeah.
Even though it was a little bit gross.
Yeah.
So I hate this for Kristen Davis that now her character's IQ has just shed 75 points in the last 3 episodes. Like, it's kind of a bummer.
It's true. I just want to note, and we'll be talking about this article on the Patreon in a few weeks, but Josie Bassett did an interview with TV Guide of all fucking things just before the season started in 1995, just before season 4 started. And in it, she talks about how there's been a change of showrunner. Apparently, Darren Star left after season 3. And, I mean, we'll get into it in that episode. But it's just interesting to think, like, okay, the new guy came in and was like, here's what we're going to do, a crazy mob story, without thinking through, like, any of the stuff that would have logically had to underpin it. Like, not only the stuff we've already said of, like, she didn't change her name. Like, she didn't even change her name. She was Amanda Woodward, and then she left him and just moved across the same country that he somehow, as a mobster, did not have the resources to track her with. But, like, in addition to that, didn't change her looks. Like, if there would be something, like, if we had seen that portrait and her hair had been brown, at least I would be like, okay, she tried.
Like, yeah.
And, you know.
on top of that, like, there were several ways into this story. If you want to get Antonio Sabato into the cast, make it a mob story.
Sure.
Make it from Amanda's past whenever she showed up on the show. There were, like, I can think of 3 ways just off the top of my head via her father to do that.
Yes.
With, like, that he was in jail. Like, she didn't have to fake her own death, and she didn't have to suck at something. Like, if she decided to disappear, it's Amanda.
Yeah.
She would get it done.
Yes.
We're supposed to believe she was this incompetent, and also that he's, like, such a, you know, evil genius for finding her when she changed nothing mm-hmm. and maintained a high profile.
Yeah. Well, we're almost done with this for now, because then we're at the airport, and speaking of Amanda not changing her looks at all, she's just, like, strolling to her gate, not mm-hmm. even wearing a hat, like, just no. looking like herself.
Yeah.
When she runs into Jack, and as soon as she sees him, she turns and hauls ass in the other direction, but he easily catches her by the arm, mm-hmm. says he just wants to talk to her, so she gives him 60 seconds, and it goes like this, clip 10.
60 seconds.
What happened with us was a long time ago. I've changed. I want to put the past behind me as much as you do. Look, you've been a missing person for 5 years. You can't be declared legally dead for 7. Imagine my life.
You must have me confused with someone who cares.
I have a fiance. I need a divorce. I want us both to have a clean slate and get on with our lives. Look, let's just meet and finalize this. A clean break, Amanda. Once and for all.
We are now boarding passenger rows 32 through 50 for South Coast Airlines, flight 736.
I can't pressure you now. Just don't get on that plane. Please.
This is the final boarding call.
Okay. In terms of the 7 years, this just came up in a CSI that we watched like 3 days ago. And in that, it was 5. So I don't know if it varies from state to state or if it changed between now and like 2003 or whatever, when that episode of CSI aired.
I think having spent some time with this concept due to like this famous case of a woman who disappeared like September 10th, 2001.
Uh-huh.
She lived near the towers, and like now it's like a podcast. It was a big New York Magazine article. Anyway,
right. mm-hmm.
I think if you have like sort of compelling circumstantial evidence that suggests they're dead versus they're just gone
mm-hmm.
and nothing has happened in any direction, then you can move the timeline up.
Right.
But that may have only happened in this case because they were trying to get her counted as one of the 9/11 victims to
right.
get into the compensation fund.
Right.
But but that could also have been the effect and not the cause. Anyway, who cares? This mm-hmm. is dumb.
It is. And remember that whole thing about being declared legally dead or not in the next episode, because mm-hmm. There are some factual challenges there as well.
Yes. Also, not terribly close attention to the actual fraud statute or, you know, definitions in the dictionary.
That and what kinds of lawyers handle what kinds of laws. But anyway, that's all going to be next week.
Sure.
Finally, we have our A plot. Kimberly's mother gets involved in her current troubles, and Matt involves Peter and Michael in his. We open on Kimberly in bed in a secure ward as a sketch artist draws Henry, formerly known as Schmob, and Peter hectors her on details. And the artist finishes her and she gasps in horror that it's him because his likeness is A, excellent, and B, includes a lot of background for some reason. Like, this isn't the Santa Monica Pier, bro. too much.
It's like a teeny little hacky sack in the foreground. Like, all right, buddy.
Everyone loves go-karts. Anyway, you can see this in the visual art aids, of course. The artist then just leaves without saying anything or with anyone thanking him.
Or paying him.
Right. So rolling over, Kimberly says he's real, but Peter suggests he may just represent someone who is, and they have to find out which is the case. And he leans over her to say he'll be back later and then gives her a classic Starverse forehead kiss.
Mm-hmm.
At the hospital, a process server distributes subpoenas to Calvin Hobbs, Michael, and Peter. Obviously, this is about Matt's case. And as he reads the paperwork, Hobbs bitches that he never said what he's accused of saying. But Michael's like, I was there. Yeah, you did. And Hobbs threatens to cut Michael's OR hours if he testifies to that, but Michael looks unconcerned. Clip 11.
I have to tell the truth. Anything else would be perjury. And perjury is your department.
You want to be politically correct, Mancini? Do it on your own dime. But don't jeopardize my livelihood for your friend.
Again, what the fuck, Peter? What the fuck?
Yeah, like, since you're playing with house money, since you really should be in jail in like three different states, why don't you just go with the subpoena?
Yeah.
Anyway. And also these line readings. Oh my God. Like they're not bad, but they are a little bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
For your friend.
Like, yeah.
what is this an homage to exactly? I don't dislike it. I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm.
He does seem to be enjoying himself though. And that's what's important.
I agree. So Michael counters that Peter's spending too much of his time advocating for Kimberly and that they would be getting more surgeries if not for Peter. But Peter doubts that, especially if Michael dimes out Hobbs. So Michael has to tell Peter what his end game is in that regard and also advise him to tell Kimberly she's never getting her job back at the hospital. I think work is probably the least of her concerns right now.
Yeah.
Saying. Speaking of which, in jail the next day, Kimberly is insisting to Peter that she doesn't know who Henry is. He's not a relative or an ex and begs Peter to leave her alone. But he says he can't because he wants to get her out. She doesn't deserve to be incarcerated, which, I mean, sure, if we're supposed to think Peter is just like, thinks all incarceration is immoral, but outside that context, it's a fair cop, as we know.
Well, yeah, this is a matter of public safety. I think most of us would agree, including Kimberly.
Anyway, as Peter hugs her, she says Henry's face is familiar, which terrifies her. So cut to the office, the Burns-Mancini suite, where Sydney is leaving Michael a snitty message about trying to get some of the money that Jane is making, because Jane and Richard are on the cover of a very shitty-looking magazine called Wear, W-E-A-R. You can see this in the visual aids. When Peter returns to the office to get Sydney's report on Michael, but she has none, calling him quiet as a patient after electroshock. Oh, Sydney.
Oh, guys.
There, but for the grace, ma'am, you have also been in a mental institution and not that long ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, she also demands time and a half plus the extra 100 a week he promised her because he made her work so late. But he's like, turn the answering service on at 6 from now on and get out because I have to make a phone call. Which he then does while she totally continues sitting there and quietly picks up the phone to eavesdrop, even though his office has glass walls. But fine. She hears all as he phones Kimberly's mother, who apparently has not been briefed on what's going on with her daughter since, you know, her arrest. So Peter catches her up, putting as good a face on where things currently are as he can, and then bringing up Henry. Does Mrs. Shaw have any idea who he might be or represent? And based on her reaction, she clearly does know exactly who Henry is, but curtly says she cannot help. But when we next see both Peter and Mrs. Shaw, he's leading her into a day room to see Kimberly, whom Peter had already briefed about this visit. Like,
yeah, what the, what?
What would have been nice to see what changed Mrs. Shaw's mind in that off-screen conversation. Oh, well.
Yeah, unless it was like a, we can't talk about this on the phone because it's tapped because of reasons. Oh, God.
So dumb. But
Show. This whole thing, well, whatever. We'll get into it.
Mm-hmm. So after brief, tense small talk, Peter tells Kimberly that Mrs. Shaw has a court order to take Kimberly back to Ohio with her. Being allowed to leave the jurisdiction seems extremely unlikely given Kimberly's legal situation. Like, if she's still in county jail, which the B-roll says she is, she still has charges pending, and I went back to the courtroom freakout where she did the flying squirrel move to see how that ended, just to remind myself. The judge said to remove her. He didn't rule on anything. So, like, the case is still happening.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, Kimberly is aghast that this decision has been made without her and implores Mrs. Shaw to leave her where she is because she's getting better. But Mrs. Shaw says if Kimberly's in Cleveland, she can come and see Kimberly every day. Kimberly begs her some more, but Mrs. Shaw's like, the car's here. Let's go. But first, Peter asks Mrs. Shaw to tell Kimberly about Henry because, I guess, since their phone call, some memories came unstuck. Not really. She knew all along. But Mrs. Shaw looks furious and tries to hustle Kimberly out. Peter snits, the world thinks Kimberly's insane. It would help Kimberly if Mrs. Shaw told her who Henry is. So here goes, and it's a long one. Clip 12.
She was just a little girl. Such a beautiful little girl.
I was in the kitchen baking a cake. Kimberly was going to be 8 years old the next day. Henry came in. He was our gardener. He had some business to discuss, and he wanted to know where my husband was, and I told him. William wasn't at home. He was away on business. And he looked at me with that big, sickening smile and tried to run, but I wasn't fast enough, and he grabbed me, and he started to rape me. Kimberly came down the stairs. My little baby girl saw him, heard me screaming, "Stop it, stop it." But he wouldn't stop. She didn't know what to do. She saw her mommy being hurt. And she screamed, "Don't you hurt her!" But he wouldn't hear. So she picked up a kitchen knife and stabbed him.
Fatally, in case that was not obvious. Yikes!
Why is this Emmy bait happening to us? She has a traumatic brain injury that we have been led to believe for like a season and a half is her motivation for everything.
Yeah.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Also, fine, do this, but get on with it.
Yeah, I don't think it goes on much longer than this. But anyway, Ms. Shaw says, because they were connected, no one pressed charges, which, like, also it was a manslaughter in defense of another, and Kimberly was a minor, probably. Mm. Not that she says that. They told Kimberly it never happened, that it was just a bad dream, and since Kimberly never brought it up, Mrs. Shaw thought Kimberly had forgotten and figured that was better. And Kimberly cries that she thought Mrs. Shaw never loved her, and Mrs. Shaw cries back that Kimberly will never know how much she always has. But she was afraid if they got too close, she would tell Kimberly and hurt her again. And as Mrs. Shaw hides her face and sobs apologies, Kimberly pets her hair. This is dumb, but I have to say, would things have gone this way in the 70s? I kind of think maybe they would. Like, I mean, look, buy that.
Someone in the writer's room read My Sweet Audrina many times. This is what happened. It was actually well acted in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was just, all of this was so unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah. I just remembered it's not over. There's still going to be more. But speaking of people fucking with the justice system or trying to, let's go over to Hobbs' office where the man himself is offering Matt $25,000 of his own money, not the hospital's, to forget everything. And Matt, taking this meeting without his lawyer, innocently peers at the check and asks if it's a settlement or a bribe. Hobbs would have thought either would work for Matt at this point, and he'll even go as high as 30. But that's not what Matt wants. Turns out, clip 13.
You just don't get it, do you, Hobbs? You think you can live in your ivory tower, do what you want, say what you want, and no one will question you?
That's not true. There's a hierarchy here at this hospital, yes.
Right. And you're the king. And everyone else is a subject. But you just can't go around firing people because they're gay. No matter how many people you bribe.
You can get off your soapbox anytime now.
Oh, no, I'm not done yet. So you've given me a new way to look at this. Now, it's personal.
Who the hell do you think you are, Fielding?
A social worker who is damn good at his job, a small fact that got lost in the mix.
You should reconsider my offer, Fielding. Or I'll have you blackballed from getting a job anywhere in L.A.
Knock yourself out, Calvin, because when I'm done with you, every hospital in L.A. will blackball you.
I love the reference to, like, Matt's damn good at his job. I'm sure he is, but boy, it's been a long time since we've seen him do it.
Mm-hmm. Also, shouldn't he technically be fired for changing medical records? That's a felony.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His shirt in the scene, by the way, is so big. You can see it in the visual aids, like, billowing. But other than that, he's, I think, quite sexy here. A good look on him.
If not entirely credible as written to date, but sure, everyone else gets a heel turn. Why not Matt?
Mm-hmm. Also, just a reminder, this is the second time that Matt has had to deal with a workplace issue where he's being discriminated against for being gay.
Yeah, because they don't know what else to do with him except issues plots like this, and that's what there is.
Yep. I mean, we did get the murder, but, you know, other than that. In the day room, Kimberly picks up puzzle pieces and wonders to Peter if she should have left with her mother. Like, if there was a court order, could she refuse? Or did her mother just drop it? What happened? Don't know.
It's not like a restaurant reservation. Like,
right.
If we don't feel like going, we just won't. That's not how that works. You killed somebody.
Right. So Kimberly doesn't think her breakthrough is worth much if she has to spend the rest of her life in a mental hospital, whereupon another patient in the room starts screaming and Kimberly decides this is what she deserves. And Peter says she's paid a steep price, but Kimberly doesn't think it's enough for the damage she's done and the people she's hurt, and they'll never let her out. And Peter says, clip 14.
Yes, they will. You internalized and shut out what happened. Any expert understands the consequences of that. They have to declare you sane. And with that declaration, I can petition for your release. And I think I can win.
Okay.
What?
But then, she still would have to face trial for a bombing someone died in. Not to mention, like, the property damage that, you know, it also happened. Like, everyone's hospital bills for their fatal injuries. Like, what?
If she's sane, that's bad for her.
Right.
Legally.
Yes. It doesn't get less complicated from here, I regret to tell you. And we'll have a lot of questions about this in the next episode. But for now, let us close it up by naming our episode MVP. Sarah.
Haley.
That's a good one.
I mean, because everyone else was just kind of fucking up, and, like, I guess we're supposed to think it's Jack Parisi, but come on.
Yeah. In order to not say that, but I agree, I'm going to say Michael just for being marginally less shitty about Matt's lawsuit, even though he's doing it for self-interested reasons, than Peter is, because what the fuck, Peter?
Yeah, but, well, really, what the fuck, Peter?
All right. Least valuable player. I hate to say it, but Amanda, try harder to get lost. Because, I mean, the only remarkable thing about this, if everything we've learned is true, is that it only took him, or that it took him as much as 5 years to track you down.
Yeah. I'm going with Jane.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, if you're going to be a bad guy, be good at being a bad guy. And, like, I don't know. Like, I guess we're supposed to think this is really scandalous that she's going to marry someone she doesn't love. But, like, of course she is.
Yeah.
It's Jane. Next time and again with this, Matt sticks to his guns, Joe sticks her nose in, Kimberly's stuck with an electronic monitor, and everyone's sticking it to Brooke. You may want to stick to bland foods yourselves before you check out our visual aids. You'll find those for this and every other episode of Again With This at againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you can find links to our very special 90210 book. You can follow us on Twitter at AWT90210 and join our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis, where any level of support gets you extra content. I'm Fourth Great Lie, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is post-traumatic retcon Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is Black Ball Round Robin, David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
Ooh.
What? Never truer.